From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Campus carry laws now bring the gun control conversation to colleges and universities in many states. And at Rutgers, there's pressure to end the substantial institutional subsidy for the university's intercollegiate athletic programs. Hi, I'm Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. So we welcome all, and ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these discussions on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. We begin our program today with a conversation about campus carry laws. Should students and college employees who have permits for concealed weapons be allowed to bring guns onto college campuses? That's a pressing issue at many colleges and universities, as seven states now have laws permitting campus carry, and legislatures in 11 states are considering campus carry laws. The arguments for and against campus carry are generally well known. Advocates cite their constitutional rights, and also some claim that a student or faculty member with a concealed weapon might help deter random shooters or other criminal activity on campus. Those opposed to campus carry, which include many campus law enforcement personnel, as well as faculty, administrators, and students, believe that more guns on campus will increase, not decrease, the risk for danger for students and campus employees. Many states that license concealed weapons typically impose restrictions on carrying a gun into K-12 schools, and some have similar restrictions that apply to college campuses. But with 11 states engaged in some type of legislative activity on campus carry issues, it is clear that the often highly charged debate about gun control that goes on off campus will now come to many college campuses. Joining us for this conversation are Furman de Brabander, who's on the Faculty of Humanistic Studies at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Shaw Ardalan, who is president of Lone Star College and University Park in Houston, and Scott Jasek, who is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. And before we begin, let me state that This Week at Inside Higher Ed approached representatives of several groups that are pro-campus carry. None responded to the invitation to participate in this discussion. So the big issues, Shaw Ardalan, at Lone Star College are well known in terms of gun control, pro and con. What are the nuances that apply? You are looking at this issue as it plays out in your college. You mentioned as before we started to roll the tape that there was several public meetings about this at your campus recently.
Yes, thank you very much, Casey. Well, when you think about it, first it came about that why is this all of a sudden the most important thing that people are talking about with all the other issues, but this is not the topic of this situation. We decided that our board of trustees and our students and our faculty decided to go out and ask the students. And you will be surprised how many people showed up and stayed all the way almost to 10 p.m. at meetings. Hundreds of students and community members and board members came, and we discussed this to say what is the actual community feels about this. And the results were very clear that everybody is now asking and suggesting, and not everybody, of course, the majority is asking for local control. Our board of trustees are supportive of that. That we need to have these conversations locally, and also our students, our faculty. The Faculty Senate just is about to pass a resolution that they don't want any guns on campus under any conditions.
And Furman de Brabander at Maryland Institute College of Art, you see this in some ways as an issue of academic freedom.
Yes, well, I have tried to imagine from the vantage point of being a professor, instructor in the classroom, what the presence of the guns, even if they're concealed, what they might mean to, you know, the goals of the classroom, what we hope to achieve there, and more broadly speaking, what we hope to achieve on the level, at the university level. How we hope to transform and nourish young minds and produce them for our democracy. We're in the business of making democratic citizens. What effect could these guns have on that process? And more broadly speaking, what do they promise to? How do they promise to change or impact the character of these institutions?
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed. Inside Higher Ed has covered this issue for several years when campus carry began to emerge. Are there nuances in the current conversations and some of the legislation in these states that makes it a little different now than it was in the past?
I think what's different now is that it is becoming a much more accepted idea, and it's spreading. Right now, we may be on the verge of campus carry coming to Texas and Florida, which are two very large, very populous states. Just a few years ago when we were writing about this issue, everyone was like, that's impossible. You wouldn't do this. The idea was that campuses have special security issues and special needs and special rights. And that idea has been seriously eroded. And frankly, I have yet to meet a college president who wants guns on campus. If I'm overlooking somebody and somebody hears this, please let me know. But there's a pretty strong campus consensus among administrators, campus security, and others that this is a bad idea.
Shaw Ardlin, I want to come back to you and also draw on the experience that you had with the town meetings at your campus. There's lots of conversation about risk versus benefit in terms of campus carry. That advocates say it might deter criminal activity. Others say it might be a catalyst for additional violence. What's the evidence? What were the conversations about risk versus benefit that you had with people in your community?
Well, what we have to do is to trust the experts that they say, well, this is our police officer. These are people that they have dedicated their life by dealing with these situations, and they always believe that it's sure that if you introduce guns into any environment, the risks are going to be higher.
And Furman, I want to come back to you about the issue of campus discourse, having guns in class. Talk a little bit more about that in terms of the actual or the inferred presence of a gun in a classroom, again, based on the piece that you wrote for Inside Higher Ed not long ago.
Well,
what
I think
to the climate and the discourse.
Well, of course, I've had to imagine what this would be like. Luckily, I teach at a university. My students don't bring the guns into the classroom. Whether they have done or not, I do not know. Of course, if this becomes law, then I would have to deal with that prospect more frankly, more openly. But on one hand, you know, I teach in the humanities. I have PhD in philosophy, and we aim to, you know, really bring these young students, out of their shell. And, I mean, quite frankly, we deal with or at least the ideal is in the humanities classroom that we are to deal with controversial issues, moral, political issues that, are going to lead to heated discussions. And I have been worried about what the prospect of guns might mean in that context if students should get especially angry or offended, which has happened. Any professor will tell you that, you know, there are going to be sharp words exchanged, there's going to be offense taken. What's going to happen? Is there a chance that violence could erupt? Well, you know, just the prospect that a gun is in the classroom, or that it could be shown if the gun is flashed. The gun rights crowd, when they weigh in on this, they say, well, you know, just the sight of guns is going to deter crime. Yes, but, showing your gun is a provocative gesture in itself, which could lead to violence. I'm worried about that. But even more than that, you know, we have a hard enough time as it is stoking discussion in the classroom, getting students to open up. And the classroom is an open space. It's a safe space. And guns, they represent everything that stands against that because,
right.
You know.
And Shaw, I want to come back to some of the cost issues that have been discussed by Texas officials. There's one estimate that it potentially could run up to $50 million over the next 5 or 6 years for Texas across campuses. Community colleges like yours, four-year institutions, and research and residential institutions, some $47 to $50 million to implement campus carry.
Yes, when you look at it, even though I was not a part of that calculation or that number, but think about it. Texas is a big state. There is only just 50 community colleges in here. Our community college has six colleges. So by the time you divide that into how many institutions are in Texas and how much per institution over 6 years, it's not going to be a big number, but it is still significant as far as cost. So think about training. You know, these police officers have been trained to, when you walk into a space and you see somebody shooting, that's the first person you take down. Now they have to get different kind of training. Also, look at the faculty. We have 6,000 employees. They need special training. And I would like to also comment about something that we heard from our faculty as far as the environment that was just mentioned in the classroom. Especially our classrooms are small, like, let's say, 30 people. That's a part of what community colleges do. The faculty said, I always make contact, and I'm looking every move of my students to make sure that they're getting it through their eyes, through their expressions, to make sure that I am transferring this knowledge as it should. But now I should be looking to see if they're wearing a gun or not.
And the looking to see if a student has a gun plays out in terms of residential facilities in Texas and elsewhere. Large numbers of students in dorms, typically they are the youngest students on campus in dorms. Many campuses have freshman residence requirements. Scott Jasek, and you know, what's the consequence of this if students not only bring stereos and computers, but they're bringing handguns with them to campus when they move into dorms at the beginning of the academic year?
It's a huge consequence, and not just the dorms, but sort of student life generally outside of the classroom. You know, we report every week on the fact that we have a national problem in this country of many students, particularly young men, drinking way too much and drinking past the point that their judgment is any good. And most college officials are pretty honest that they don't really know how to deal with that totally. The question needs to be asked, do you want drunk 19-year-olds with guns? Because that's what you're talking about on most campuses on a Saturday night. And so there needs to be a certain reality check, perhaps, of what we're talking about, which isn't just a well-trained, mature student looking for people to protect, but of people who are not necessarily of fully sound mind.
Sean, let me come back to you in terms of who should make this decision. You said earlier you thought it should be local. Are local officials, yourself as a president of a local institution, any far more removed from the pressures pro and con about this issue than folks in the state legislature?
Yes, Casey. If you don't mind, I would like to make one more comment about the environment, because my campus is also a whole different situation that I have daycare on my campus. I have a high school on my campus. So these are minors walking around and sometimes in the same classrooms as the adults or the 21-year-old and older. And the last thing that is not going to be also very interesting is going to be interesting for you to know that today the conversations are talking about not just concealed gun, but open carry guns on campus. So there are 60 different bills filed and this going on. But again, going back to controls and decision making, our board of trustees are elected by the communities that we serve here. And I think it's just one of the promises of our founding fathers that, you know, you need to make sure that these elected individuals have the power to make the best decision for their colleges. That's what they have been elected for, to decide what is in the best interest of these colleges, and this is what the Board of Trustees are elected for, to make decisions that is convenient for us, that makes sense for us. So that's where the decisions are made locally
and reflect local values. Scott, where does this go? There are 11 states that now have legislation before them about campus carry.
I think where it goes right now is I expect some more states to pass it this year. It is very popular with a certain segment of the public and a certain legislators who are close to gun groups or gun lobby. You combine that with governors who are sympathetic, I think it's likely to pass, and I think more colleges are going to find themselves not opposing it, but figuring out how to deal with it.
Great. Furman DeBrabander from the Maryland Institute College of Art, Shaw Ardlin, Lone Star College, University Park in Houston, and Scott Jasek, thank you for talking with us about the challenge of that campus carry presents to many colleges and universities across the country today. In our second segment today, we'll talk about athletic subsidies at Rutgers University. As we approach the final weekend of March Madness, there's no doubt that college sports are a very big business. And at Rutgers University in New Jersey, a new member of the Big Ten, which now really has 14 members, Rutgers is a textbook example of a university that is trying to upgrade its visibility and reputation by joining one of the nation's premier athletic conferences. But the athletic upgrade comes at major cost to expand programs and upgrade facilities, as well as a pushback on both the campus and in the New Jersey legislature about the incurring additional costs. Athletic revenues cover only about 60% of the cost of the intercollegiate athletic program at Rutgers, and the athletic department has run significant deficits for almost a decade, from $20 million about a decade ago in 2005-2006 to a total of $83 million over the past two academic years. The deficits have been covered by student fees and transfers from the university's discretionary program funds. What may differentiate the criticism about the money spent on athletics at Rutgers from other institutions is that a recent Faculty Senate report documented the size and the source of the subsidies, money that many faculty at Rutgers feel should be used to support academic programs. Joining us for the conversation are Mark Killingsworth, he's a professor of economics at Rutgers, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So Mark Killingsworth from Rutgers, let me begin with you. No surprise that big-time athletic programs run deficits. There have been news reports that maybe a half a dozen at best of the largest programs in the country are cash positive. What differentiates the situation at Rutgers?
Well, Rutgers is different basically by orders of magnitude more. It's true. Not very many schools make a profit or finish in the black. Most of them finish in the red, but the shortfalls at most schools are pretty modest. Illinois, for instance, has a $6 million deficit. Maryland has a $17 or $18 million deficit. Last year, Rutgers' deficit was double that. And it's been that way for a very long time, since at least 2003-04. Through the end of the 2014 fiscal year, Rutgers racked up $287 million in deficits on its athletics program, and that's just intercollegiate athletics. This isn't anything to do with intramurals. So that's much, much greater than virtually all other schools. In fact, the Rutgers deficit is larger than all of the deficits of all of the other Big Ten schools combined. So we may not be much on the gridiron, but we're great in terms of getting conference record deficits.
You run well in the red, no question. Scott, from the outside, you know, those are big numbers that we heard from Mark Killingsworth. Put those in context for us, if you will, in terms of the other major conferences and the pushback at many institutions about money for athletics versus academic programs.
I think they are quite large. I was going to say impressively large, but I'm not sure Rutgers faculty would like the word impressively there. But I think Rutgers is significant and different for a few reasons. There are campuses all over the country where faculty members complain about sports spending, and sometimes they even get geared up and have a committee meet on it. I'd say Rutgers faculty have, more than most, really dug into the numbers and kept at the issue year after year. There are a lot of faculty who have tried this at other places one year or one semester, and generally they give up. At Rutgers, the faculty have kept at it and continued to track the spending and to push for changes in a way that I think stands out.
Mark Killingsworth, one of the things that in the news coverage that seems to also differentiate Rutgers, other than the size of the deficits, is the fact is this has now become an off-campus story, that there have been comments from the legislature, from the governor as well, about the priority and the spending on athletics compared to other issues, other sources of spending, other sources of revenue at Rutgers.
Well, I'm fond of saying that when it comes to collegiate athletics, the brains of many politicians turn to jelly. And I think our governor is a pretty good example of that. He has now been talking up the need for Rutgers to spend more on athletics because Rutgers is now part of the Big Ten, and we have to be competitive with all the other schools in the Big Ten, including the behemoths like Ohio State. And so that's going to require more money, and you can go on from there. You need more money for facilities because in order to attract better recruits, better student athlete players, you've got to have impressive facilities, so you need to spend more money on that. And the Big Ten and other conferences, large so-called power conferences, have now been allowed to start supporting athletes much more generously than before by the NCAA. So a lot of people, a lot of political figures in New Jersey are talking up the need to spend more. One state senator has been talking up in particular the need to expand the physical facilities, the basketball arena and various other sports facilities. The interesting thing is that none of these political figures are saying where the money for this is going to come from. And I think their strategy is it's going to come from somewhere else, because they're certainly not talking about additional state government support for Rutgers.
Let's go back to the Big Ten issue, Mark. You're a new member of the Big Ten. Maryland is a new member. We see other campuses in other parts of the country trying to glom into the larger conferences. Is this about reputation and visibility? And you know, how will you measure, how will the university officials measure the benefit of Big Ten membership in 2 or 3 years?
Well, it's hard to say. The major benefit for Rutgers of joining the Big Ten is that by virtue of being in the Big Ten, we will share in the very lucrative media contract that the Big Ten is going to sign with the media, because the Big Ten gets huge amounts of money selling the rights to broadcast its games. And I have to say, I thank God every morning when I wake up that Rutgers has joined the Big Ten, because we would be in infinitely worse shape if we didn't have the prospect in a few years' time of collecting large revenues from the Big Ten. Otherwise, the problem is that, and this I think is what agitates some of our political figures, they're afraid that we're going to get beaten regularly on the gridiron and on the basketball arena. And they may be right. And so what they're then going to start talking up is the need, as I said, for more facilities to get better recruits and post a better record in football, basketball, et cetera. So the mantra is, I think, you have to spend money to make money. But I think in reality, it's just you have to spend money in order to spend more money.
Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, there's been a lot of conference jumping, or at least some efforts at conference jumping beyond just Rutgers and Maryland. Talk with us about that, and talk with us particularly with those campuses that have done it 2 or 3 years later. Have they accrued the benefits that they hoped for?
Well, it's certainly true, as Mark said, that a college that joins a conference with a larger TV payout gets more money. That's true. On the other hand, many people feel things are lost, that rivalries that were once actually regionally based are lost, that students who have to fly rather than take a short trip are, you know, lose the time in class and on campus, that, you know, how many people are really fooled into thinking that Rutgers is a Midwestern university. There are a lot of great universities that aren't in the Big Ten. And the costs do go up as well. If you play with the, you know, in the big leagues, you are expected to pay your coaches more. You are expected to win more. You're expected to compete in all sorts of contests for, like, the biggest Jumbotron or whatever. So the costs go up as well.
Mark, let me come back to you about the issue of alumni support. Clark Kerr once famously quipped that for a college president, there were three major challenges: football for alumni, parking for faculty, and sex for students. Of course, he said that in the 1960s, when sex was more of an issue for students than it might be today, depending on the particular campus. But alumni and football clearly are a big issue. The Inside Higher Ed story that appeared this week talked about how alumni support for football at Rutgers or athletics is significantly below that of some of the peer institutions that are now part of the Big Ten by orders of magnitude. And yet, you know, is the hope that by joining a much more visible conference, that that will be a catalyst for more alumni dollars to support the athletic program?
I certainly hope so. I get emails from alums who were very upset about the Senate's vote calling for fiscal restraint. By the way, we weren't saying that you necessarily have to cut athletic spending. We just want the deficit to be reduced, and you can do that either by cutting spending or by raising revenue or some combination of the two. And a prime way to do it would be to get more contributions from alums. But when I get these emails from irate alumni who say, I contribute every year to Rutgers Athletics, my temptation is to say, gee, I wish there were more of you. because the contributions from Rutgers alums to the Rutgers athletics program are really embarrassingly low. They gave $8.1 million in contributions to Rutgers in the last fiscal year. Indiana, which splits the market with two schools, Indiana University and Purdue, generated a total of $32 million in contributions. And Indiana's got only about 70% of the median household income that we have in New Jersey, and they've got only about two-thirds of the population. New Jersey's got the second largest number of millionaires in the United States, and yet the contributions that people make to Rutgers athletics is really embarrassingly small. And I think part of the reason for that is that the athletics department has gotten these massive subsidies, and that means that they don't have much incentive to go out and hustle and start raising more money from alums and elsewhere, because they know that if they run a deficit, the university is going to write them a check to cover it. By the way, the reason the faculty are upset about this is that even President Barchi, the president of Rutgers, has conceded quite explicitly that athletics is siphoning dollars from the academic mission. So it's no great mystery about where the money to finance the athletics deficits is coming from. It's coming from student fees, they have to pay more, and it's coming from athletics programs, or money that could have been used for athletics programs, academic programs.
But won't the competition then for alumni dollars, you know, increase in terms of athletics versus academics? Scott, again, you know, watching what's going on at Rutgers as well as elsewhere.
Well, I think some of it actually does have to do with geography. When I was joking earlier about Rutgers not being in the Midwest, that actually is a disadvantage. If you look at some of the Midwestern Big Ten state universities, their athletics programs are the dominant athletic interest for anyone in their state. If you're at Rutgers, you're competing with professional teams in New Jersey, New York City, Philadelphia. There are lots of ways for a football fan in New Jersey to get excited about his or her favorite sport without going to Rutgers or giving a penny to Rutgers. The other thing I would caution about is that it is very common for alumni to complain about athletics decisions and to say, you know, we're not going to give another penny till you fire this coach or start this program or stop this program. Generally, those are people who haven't given much, period. Building up a tradition of giving and, frankly, of winning doesn't happen overnight, even if you switch to the Big Ten.
And Mark Killingsworth, given that you and your colleagues effectively did the equivalent of forensic accounting to document not just a year of subsidy, but a decade of substantial subsidies, what are you hearing from your academic colleagues at other institutions who have concerns about the dollars that athletic programs are siphoning off from academic programs?
Well, I would say that the biggest, most noteworthy episode was at University of California, Berkeley, where the Faculty Senate did just the same sort of thing that we did. They expressed great reservations and unhappiness about the about Berkeley's project to expand the stadium there and spend a great deal of money upgrading it, expanding it, and so forth. So I think part of it is part of the reason why more faculty are not protesting and doing things like what they did at Berkeley is that faculty feel these days, and I think they're right, that at a large state university, public university, it's a big corporation, and the ability, faculty are mere employees now, and the ability of faculty to change the course of the institution is really quite limited. It's in the hands of the Board of Trustees, Board of Governors, the governing body, and also the senior administration. It's no accident that not just at Rutgers, but elsewhere, the number of senior administrators has jumped far more than either enrollment or the number of faculty. Administration has become a big business all its own, and they're the ones who are making the decisions and calling the shots. I think the ability of the faculty to wrest control over athletics is really pretty limited, and you've got to be pretty determined and pretty persistent if you want to budge, move the needle, really even a modest little bit.
And Scott, how does the situation at Rutgers sort of set a precedent or cast a shadow over the continuing conversation, some might say the tension, between academic program dollars and athletic program dollars?
Well, if you look at this year, it's been a very rough one for advocates of Big Time athletics programs, in that while we have all the hoopla right now about the Final Four, we have seen really horrible academic scandals related to athletics at UNC Chapel Hill and now at Syracuse. I think many faculty experiencing those sorts of scandals or the sorts of budget deficits at Rutgers are saying they have to get more involved. The irony I've always found over the years is the number of faculty who don't dig in and sort of assume that athletics must be turning a profit, or they assume that because the football team does, or they see a television contract. The reality is a lot of faculty have looked the other way, and to me the question is, do they get involved?
Great. Mark Killingsworth, professor of economics at Rutgers, and Scott Jasek, from Inside Higher Ed, thank you for this informative conversation about big university athletic programs. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or podcast early afternoon on most Fridays. On the web, we're available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. This Week is also available on iTunes. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of our webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.